Hi, I'm Erica LaRose, and this is Shilapacho. Welcome to another episode of Shuttle Pod Show. We have very special guest, Greg Henry. We'll be answering some of your fan questions, doing some Star Trek trivia, talking about which books and or TV shows we're into. As always, Patreon members will also get the extended version of this conversation, Stuck on an Island with Connor Trenier, and How Well Do You Know Your Guest, and much more. My name's Erica LaRose. And now for our host, Connor Trenier, and our guest host, Mark Cartier.
Hey!
Hi, guys!
Hi! Mark, how was last episode for you?
Oh, it was great.
Yeah,
I really like this being on camera thing. it's being so attractive that...
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're doing a good job being attractive.
You are. You're doing a fantastic job.
Born to do it.
Right. Oh, and we want to give another shout out to our... compatriot Dom, who is still on injured reserve. He will be back when he's better. Hi, Dom. We're thinking of you and
miss you a lot.
Yeah, and can't wait to get you back in the seat. So, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Treks and Trekkers, we are so honored to have as our guest today Greg Henry.
Woo!
Yay!
Hey. I worked. He and I did an episode of Enterprise Dawn where we really didn't speak to one another. So this will be fantastic and all new information because Greg spoke almost exclusively in, well, it wasn't gobbledygook. It was somewhat of an alien language.
Somewhat of an alien language, yeah.
Yeah, but we were stuck on a deserted asteroid / planet, call it what you will. And I was just telling Greg that the episode was based on Hell in the Pacific, which is Toshiro Mifune and Lee Marvin. And it's a U.S. soldier and a Japanese soldier trying to figure out if they can get along or not. And they made that into Enemy Mine later on. And then Enterprise did its own version of that with the two of us battling it out. You had to wear a ton of prosthetic and makeup.
Yes, a ton of it. Yeah, absolutely.
What was it like?
Oh, well, I've sort of been through this several times in my career, so it's always, you know, the harsh awakening of cold glue on your face at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
That's what you remember most specifically. But then, you know, go through the... It was about 3.5 hours when we first started, and then it got down to 2.5, I guess.
Right.
By the time we were working every day, you know.
And you were, it was clavicle to.
Yeah, it was here all through, all head, all neck. The hands was just, no appliances on the hands, but they had to do the hands as well.
And right.
Then
right.
The rest was suit, yeah.
I remember it was on Stargate Atlantis where I played a character that had, you know, prosthetics and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, when you get there at 3 a.m., you are not that character.
No.
And then the interesting thing was, is that it starts to evolve on your face in a way. And yeah. I don't know how you work exactly, but the character began to show up for me in the morning. And by the time it was done, contact lenses were in. I just felt different. And I felt like it really assisted my performance.
Oh, without question. It's like, you know, 85% of the performance, you know, it's like it's mask work, right? And so it's, you know, you have to get this feeling of the mask and get what the feeling of the mask is in the mirror. You have to see what it looks like and works like, and you have to practice with it in your dressing room. And
right.
And, you know, you don't get much time to do that in the makeup chair because they're so busy, you know, right, right. It just takes so much work. So if you get that, you know, that hour after it's done, you know, that's when the learning sort of begins and you got to make like a couple of, you know, quick decisions that might stick with you for the whole, whole thing, whether you want them to or not.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. I mean, your physicality changes.
And,
well, and you figure something out on day three that you can't go back to day one and do from the beginning.
Exactly.
That's going to suck.
Hey, guys, I got an idea.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Uh-uh.
We're done.
Yeah. That, not going back for that. Yeah.
Now, did you read for it?
No, I don't think so. No. No,
yeah, I would have thought that would be a hard audition to do.
To read for. For the,
Because we were talking earlier, it was like, I don't think that there was English translation to what you were necessarily saying to me. There were some words eventually that, that the character learned, but it was...
No, it was just kind of this phonetic language thing that... And I don't recall exactly, but I think there might have been, you know, sort of parenthetical statements of what it, the meaning was.
Right.
You know, but pronunciation, I was kind of all on my own. And so we, you know, we sort of did it that way.
Did you ever have the script supervisor after a cut say, I'm sorry, but it was an ack, not an ick.
God, I wish I would have.
As you know, Star Trek was like, you had to be word perfect.
Yeah. Well, this would have been grunt and growl perfect, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
How long did you have to work on it before you shot?
On, I don't know. A few days, couple days, you know.
Were you just going around talking?
Well, you kind of, I guess in the script, it sort of described them as somewhat lizard-like. I don't know. Maybe a little bit. I'm not sure of that. But you make some decisions without the makeup, but then you'd get the makeup and they all sort of that, like change, know, and they all adapt, you know, they kind of morph. But then you can use those things that you had the days before and for that hour before you have to go do it. Yeah.
So did you're multifaceted, multi-talented. You sing, we heard you play piano down there. You've got albums, you write musicals. What did you start with as a young person? Like, did you want to be an actor? Did you want to be a musician? Did you want to be either one?
Well, you know, it wasn't sort of consistent for me from childhood. I think I sort of was like, you know, like a lot of people, sort of firemen, you know, astronaut and things like that when I was a kid. And my mother had me take piano lessons, which I did reluctantly, you know, and I sort of, we fought terribly when I was like about 11.
Well, we're glad she won out.
to quit them. Yeah. And I quit them and didn't play the piano for about 5 years. And then I met somebody that sort of taught me how to play the blues. And so I was then reinvested in it. Mm-hmm. In high school and college, I got into acting. And then I went to acting school at the University of Washington.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Yeah. So I was up there with Gene Smart and, you know, other people, Pamela Reed and others that you might know, Daryl Anderson.
Yeah, Jeffrey Combs went to that.
Jeffrey Combs was up there, yeah. Yeah.
That had a golden age, that University of Washington. PTTP. What was the program called?
Give me acronyms. PTT. Professional Actors Training Program.
That's what it was.
Yeah, PATP. Yeah. Well, that was when Duncan Ross was running it. And that was sort of its highlight. It had, I forget what the guy's name was who followed him, but Duncan Ross ran it when I was there. Mm-hmm. And it did have, you know, that's back when... Bachelor of Fine Arts programs, conservatory work, in other words, for actors, there were like 8 in the country.
Right, right.
Right.
Now throw a rock.
Now there's like throw a rock. Yeah, exactly right. They're everywhere. So that was part of its status. It was sort of an elite club at that point in time.
Right.
You know, so I went there and that's where I auditioned after I went to a couple of years at another school and that solidified it, you know, but I was pretty sure by the end of my freshman year, what I wanted to do, did that all through that. I played music all through that. I played the piano, wrote songs and things, came to LA. And the first year I was in a band here, going extremely broke. I was working in a restaurant and playing in a band, and then I was like, well, maybe I have to give up the restaurant for the band. We sort of had some gigs and things, and I did that, and it's like money just vanished. And I was like, wait a minute, I just went to school for 3 years for what? Sort of came back to my senses, you know, and then got back and I had got some other day job here selling on the phone, and then ended up going down to San Diego and worked at the Old Globe and got the acting started again.
And that's where you did As You Like It, and were you somewhat discovered?
Somewhat, there? Yes. Yeah, absolutely. yeah, I was in As You Like It I was there as an intern, so I was making the whoppy $60 a week, you know.
Still broke.
Still broke, but just a pinch better than the other. And I understudied Orlando, and then I went on as Orlando like four or five times, and audience member was Joel Thurm, and Joel Thurm was a big casting person, and they were looking for a person to play Nick Nolte's son in the part two of Rich Man, Poor Man. Mm. And so he recommended me to Pam Dixon. I came up, had an audition. William Morris signed me the next day.
This is like it happens to everybody.
And then I went back down to do more Shakespeare for three more days. And then they called me and I got the part and came up.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good start.
It was a good start, a very good start, you know. So I was quite lucky in that way.
Now, I saw a photo of you with George Kennedy.
Oh, yeah.
What was that project?
That was called Mean Dog Blues. That was the first movie that I starred in, had a starring part in. Who else was in it? Scatman Crothers was in it. Kay Lenz.
What was George Kennedy like?
He's great.
Was he?
He's a great guy. It could have also been Just Before Dawn. We were in that together as well. Oh. We were in a couple movies together. But Mean Dog Blues was the first one. And he's just a sweet guy and, fun to talk to on a set. Liked him a lot.
Yeah. Did you continue doing both theater and obviously film and television here? Did you ever go to New York?
I never lived in New York. No, I've worked there a few times.
Yeah. Yeah, I tried it for 2 years, and I'm a West Coast kid.
What made you come to L.A., from college?
Well, I think because of my initial love was the movies in high school, more than theater. I really wasn't that well acquainted with theater. I was from Denver, and,
You're born in Denver?
A couple of musicals come through every year, and that's about
the touring
all.
Yeah. Companies.
That's about all you see. Yeah, I was. Yeah, and So I loved the movies, and that's what I wanted to do.
You knew.
So, yeah, I had it here. But I also didn't think that they were, exclusive. I thought they were all part of one thing, And there's many different understandings of that.
Well, yeah.
You'll find over the course of your career.
Right. The theater community here is, while I think full of very, very, very talented people, it's not, I don't know. The 99-seat theater situation is you certainly can't make a living in the theater in L.A. They'll pay for your gas.
No. Being actually a part of sort of growing 99-seat theater back in the day in the 80s, it was you weren't going to make any money. As a matter of fact, you're going to lose money doing it. But what it was is that you could do your art. What it was not, auditioning for, this guest shot or that guest shot or whatever.
Right.
It was, you were able to practice your craft and you were able to, sometimes if lucky, make a little art,
Right.
And you could do that on a volunteer basis.
Right.
Which, it seems to me art should be voluntary, you should be able to say, I would like to do this.
Right.
And we went through and Joe Stern, whose theater we're in here, the Matrix Theater, was very much a leader in sort of like trying to establish that 99-seat waiver thing so that small theaters could operate. And we And we did that. And, you know, and we had a company at first, and then later my wife, who was a theater director, the two of us formed a production company, and we produced probably a dozen plays that were all new plays. Mm-hmm. Some of them we were trying to push toward making movies out of, and some just for the sake of the plays. So that's how I mostly kept my hand in. You know, I did some regional theater, South Coast, went to New York, did a play here and there, you know, but that's how I kept my hand in theater for the most part. I did one at the Taper as well, but...
And you continue to this day to stay involved in...
Oh, yeah.
In theater, yeah.
Does your wife ever direct you?
All the time. All the time.
Every day.
With the emphasis on all.
That's a fantastic...
Is that fun?
Answer.
No, she's a brilliant director, and it's great when we work together. We work together very well. She has a play right here, right now, at the Matrix Theater called Little Theater, which actually talks about small theater, waiver theater in the 90s. It's very much about that, which is a Los Angeles scene kind of thing.
Right.
So it's local, but I think the play is quite universal and sort of a mentor mentee type of story. And it's funny.
Yeah, which our producer Chris is involved with.
Ooh.
Yes, Chris is the master of sound.
That's
the
right.
Maestro.
Didn't the LA Times say that specifically about your work in the review?
Yeah. Top of the review. Boy, does it sound good. Yeah.
Good job, Chris.
Thanks.
I wanted to ask you, speaking of theater, about the Shakespeare in the Park.
Yeah.
Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
And there was a lot going on outside of that, too, in terms of... You were sort of dressed up as Donald Trump. It was
we went right at it.
You did.
Yep.
And were you part of that creative decision?
Yeah. I got a call that they were interested, and then they continued to be interested, and I got a call that Oscar Eustace wanted to meet me in San Francisco. I was in Vancouver. He was in LA. He was in New York and then going to San Francisco. So we met in San Francisco. He had Hamilton opening there or something, I think. And we talked about it and what it was going to be. And he was like, he was, you know, pretty sure that he wanted to go right at the look of Trump and as Caesar, which... You know, every sort of new president, it always happens. You know,
sure.
There was a production from the Guthrie that had Obama as Caesar. You know, but you find out the difference in how to manipulation of the media in terms of all of that what happened in New York.
And what did happen?
Yeah, what happened?
Well, what happened was that we were doing previews.
Yeah. And a preview is?
And a preview is before, and this was a early preview. A preview is when you first have kind of invited house, or you have, you know, some poor students that get to come or whatever. You get the feeling. No, not critics. Quite specifically, not critics.
Okay.
Quite specifically, not the press.
Because you guys can stop and go during that time, or
usually preview you just
don't
go.
At all. Okay.
Yeah, it's the show. It's sort of the final stage before you're doing it.
But you can still
it.
Make changes.
Yeah.
That's the point.
There's still notes. Yeah. There's still
yeah. I mean, Shakespeare has a problem with that, but you know, but you so you can still do that. But there was an audience, and of course, in the park, as in all theaters, no cameras allowed, no filming allowed, none of that is allowed.
Mm.
It's illegal. Well, some right-wing clowns got in, and they filmed the scene of Caesar's death, which happens every time the play is done.
Right.
Yeah.
But they made a big sort of thing out of it, and they released it, and they released that on Breitbart. And then once Breitbart got a hold of it, it infected the entire right-wing sort of universe. Mm. And in some ways, Oscar wanted to do that, but not exactly that way. So it became quite a hot button issue, the play, and got a lot of press.
were there security concerns? Or?
And there became security concerns because ultimately these people came later and were filming. And one night, it's right after, you know, stab, 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 et tu, Brute, I'm dead, lying down there. And all of a sudden I hear, this is violence against our president. This is violence against our, against our country. This is violence. I'm like, well, somebody's standing up in the audience. And then this is violence against, I'm like, God, they're getting close. And then I'm like, oh my God, this woman is on the stage.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
She came up on the stage screaming this, at which point, you know, security starts to come from the house, you know, to get her.
So they got to catch us.
What's funny, it was just the stabbing scene. There's all these actors standing there.
I know, right, exactly. With these
now, the knives are all fake, you know, but still, the first reaction is to get the hell off the stage.
How many actors does it take to protect a stage?
But I'm lying there dead, like looking at it all like this.
Yeah.
You know, sort of like, well, am I?
Is everything okay?
And she just keeps screaming at the top of her lungs. And finally, security gets her. And they get her, pulling her off the stage. And by this time, I'm like leaning up. I'm just sitting there looking at it, you know, and you know, because all the lights are up, house is up, everything's been brought up, and they're hauling her off. And as they're hauling her off down the vine, screaming at the top of her lungs, another guy is filming and starts screaming, "You're all gerbils! You're all gerbils!" And we're like looking at each other.
What does that mean?
We're all gerbils. And as he gets closer to the stage, "You're all gerbils." Oh, we're gerbils. We're gerbils.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I get it. We're gerbils.
Right.
So we all are having a laugh up there, you know. And security gets him and hauls him out. And she's still screaming on the outside of the theater.
Yeah.
Whoa.
And she did that. She continued that screaming act even as we tried to get started again, as we tried to lower the lights. She continued to scream until finally the police arrested her and hauled her away.
Wow. And
well, they didn't want to arrest her at first. She wanted to be arrested.
Yeah, sure.
She'd already raised her bail.
Yeah.
She already did a GoFundMe to raise her bail.
Oh wow. My gosh.
And she she made money on the deal. Anyway.
It's a good
gig. But the point of it was, the reason, I mean, Oscar changed the schedule was, decided to do that play, and decided to direct it, because of the highly politically charged time.
Right.
And as he said many times, you know, the message of the play is, you know, Brutus and Cassius, honorable men, kill the tyrant to try and save the Republic.
Right.
But what happens is everybody that follows Caesar then goes to war with him, and they kill the Republic, and it's not it becomes an empire, and it's not a Republic again for another 1800 years.
Right. Right.
You know? So
the people like the tyrant, you know, not the representatives.
And well, yeah. And what happens is, if you're not careful how you address and how you deal with those problems, they metastasize and they become worse. So that's sort of the lesson of the play. He just did a brilliant job directing it. It was a hugely theatrical experience and one of the, you know, top experiences of my life.
Yeah, I was going to say, I must have been, you know, sort of bucket list stuff to be able to go do, you know, Shakespeare in the Park.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's...
Yeah, it was.
That's right up there for any theater person.
The set looks really cool. I'm just looking at it right now.
Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah.
Is there a picture of the lady on the stage screaming?
No, I haven't gotten that far.
Who was your Brutus?
Well, there might be a... That was Corey Stoll was Brutus. And John David Thompson. I might have the middle name wrong. Was Cassius.
Portia.
Nikki James was Portia. It was a great company, great experience. Like you say, it was kind of a bucket list thing. And, you know, that was the thing in the meeting with Oscar, you know, it's like, we're talking about it and I'm saying, yeah, let's do it. Let's make this, you know, make him Trump. Let's go after it. Let's make it political as we can. And he says one more thing. I said, yeah. I said, you know, well, what is it? I said, this is a dream come true, you know? And he says, well, one more thing. And I said, well, so I've always wanted to do this. And he's like, you know, you're going to be naked. You're getting out of the tub naked. And
God damn it.
And I'm like, so my dream come true and my worst nightmare.
All in one.
So,
yeah. Had you done a lot of Shakespeare over the years?
Yeah, I've done a fair amount. Yeah. I've as I told you, I was down there at the Old Globe, and then I did a season at Denver Center, where I did Prince Hal, and you know, I sort of kept my hand in when I was younger. I sort of stopped doing Shakespeare after a while, though.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
What's your favorite thing about theater that you don't get to experience on film or TV?
People. Yeah.
Oh, the audience.
Yeah, they're right there.
Yeah, you love them.
Yeah. You get to, you know, you feel their love or...
yeah, right.
No, or
but,
not.
No, or not. But it's that interaction that is... Yeah. That is... it's a special ethereal kind of thing. Mm. Yeah, and that's for any performer, I think. Sure, you know?
I describe the process, too, as in theater... You have the rehearsal process and you're trying to figure out a cake from scratch, a cake that is your production, and you're throwing salt in and sugar in and flour. And one day you might have a good mixture and the next day that mixture falls apart. And eventually you get to opening night and you go, here's my cake. I hope you like it. And then in film and television, you're there making it every day and making the cake right then and there. And so you
somebody don't, else is fixing your cake sometimes.
And exactly. You know, and then somebody else might take a look at your cake and go, now we're going to take some of that cake out and then we're going to give it out to them.
Yep.
You don't have the control of your cake in a way.
Here's your slice.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. And as an actor, when you're doing theater, once it goes up, nobody's cutting or doing anything. Mm-hmm. It's just you, you know. So there is a small sense of control there. Yeah.
People who haven't done any theater or much theater or a long run never get to understand what it's like to be doing something for 6-9 months where there gets to a point where it's almost like you get on stage and every night it's like there's a new set of trees you can hide behind and look around, and you get this freedom in performance having done it so many times that you can just sort of let it all go and just see what happens, as opposed to kind of like drive it every night. At least that's what I find.
Oh, so yeah, I think it, yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, the challenge and the crazy freedom of it is that, right? Is making it different every night, is to try to make it alive every time as you do it multiple times, you know?
Right.
Once you're into, you know, your 100th performance, I mean, that's more than Kubrick's even going to ask of you. You know right. what I mean? Yeah. So,
Speaking of film directors, you seem to be, you come back to them over and over again. I mean, was it James Gunn, Brian De Palma did 6 movies with?
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? How that came about? I mean, you seem to be somewhat of a company member for at least De Palma.
Well, you know... You know, I was lucky enough that he would have me come back and work. The first thing was Scarface, the first movie. And that my agent sort of talked me into because it was one line. The part was one line. And I was like, well, I'm not reading for one line. And she's like, well, you know, you get to do a scene with Al. And I'm like, all right, I'll go read for it. And I went to read for it, and I read with Marty Bregman, who was the producer. There's no casting director. It was just I came in. I had a little meeting about 15 minutes with Marty, and he says, you want to read the part? You know, I said, sure. So, and my part was, how do you do, Mr. Montana? And he said, great, you got the part.
That's awesome.
So that's how that went. So that's where Brian, you know, I first met Brian.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a shot that he does in it. This is one of his great De Palma sort of floating push-in shots that he does on me in that. And then later, you know, sort of rounding this all out in terms of theater, it's when he was doing Body Double. We had the theater downtown at the old embassy, and we were doing a show down there. And Brian was casting, and Howard Gottfried. Howard was the producer on Body Double, and his assistant came to see the play. Oh. And she just dropped my name in, and Brian was able to go, oh, yeah, he was in Scarface. Sure, let's bring him in. So, and that began a long process of callbacks and screen tests, like the old days type screen tests with full crew and, you know,
costume and makeup,
several actors, and costume, makeup, the whole thing. Yeah.
Wow. Oh,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, so then once that was established, then the relationship after that was sort of, he'd call and ask if I wanted to do it. You know?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. So after that we did, Raising Cain, which was great. And I've spent my life sort of defending, the genius of De Palma, because critics are very tough on him, but, yeah.
That's cause they're jealous,
but well, he was living in, he was living up in the hills outside of Palo Alto, which is where we shot the movie. And had me come up with Lithgow and we rehearsed, for about, oh, I guess 10 days, maybe 8 days, maybe something like that. We rehearsed every day at his place, and he was just getting into Apple computers, and he was able to like storyboard with like little triangles and X's and little O's. And
he was all into that.
He was deeply into that because he's very sharp technically. And so he's ahead of the curve in that. And we sort of, you know, finished writing the script, he finished the touches, things he wanted to change on the script.
Together.
There.
Yeah.
And I did all, as you know, it's a multiple, maybe you don't know, it's a multiple personality thing for Lithgow. So whenever he was talking with his alter ego, I was always the alter ego off stage, off camera.
Right.
As well as playing the detective in the movie. And one of the detectives. And so that was the next one, and I've heard that they've actually made a film. They've recut it because Brian sort of jumbles things when he puts them together, you know, in his sort of way. And someone, a Gen Zer, I think, of somebody, took it and put it all in chronological order, recut the whole thing.
Huh.
And asked De Palma what he thought of it, and he loved it. So there is a version now that is a totally different version than the one I remember. I haven't seen it.
Interesting.
Yeah, but it's a chronological order of that.
Had you had the luxury before of rehearsing?
We rehearsed, Body Double. We rehearsed full on like a theater, taped out the floor where things were going to be. We rehearsed for 2 weeks. Yeah.
Wow, I've never had that luxury. Because, you know, you all should know that typically, at least in television, your rehearsal is, here's where I'm going to stand. Well, we're going to light you.
Oh, yeah.
Then you're going to take off and we're going to light it. And you're going to come in and do it. And the idea that you could have rehearsal before any kind of filming starts to get a sense of what you're doing and a company idea with each other is a foreign idea in television, at least.
In television, it is a foreign idea. I've never had the experience in television. But right. I've had it in several films, probably five films, something like that, five or six films where we rehearsed. And Brian's was perhaps the most intensive in terms of having the entire set mapped out in terms of really blocking and doing things, you know.
I mean, like with a finished script and or are you improvising and all the above or
no, I mean, Brian, you know, he allows improv, but yeah. It was a finished script.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're doing proper scene work on the set that you're going to be.
So you can sort of get a feel of what it's going to feel like, what your proximity is going to be like, you know.
Right.
Of course, you never get the feeling of what it's like until you get on the set with him, and he's got some crane that's sitting like way the hell back,
right.
And it comes zooming in from like, you know, 20 yards away to pick you up on a shot. You know, that stuff you don't
exactly
know.
Act naturally on that one.
Yeah, but yeah.
And what's you know, going from those sorts of films to, you know, the big mega green screen, Guardians of the Galaxy kind of stuff. What's that like?
Well, my part in Guardians of the Galaxy is a human. So I'm on Earth.
You're lucky.
Yeah. So there's not a lot of green screen involved with it, but I did, you know, I did James's, first movie, Slither. Mm-hmm. And we got along great. And so then I did a lot of things with him after that. Super. And I did an online series for him. I did something, and another small thing that was for the internet only. And so we just worked together, mm-hmm. you know. And so that's how, you know, he called me up and had me. Said, you want to come do this? And I said, sure. What's the part? And he said, Grandpa. And I said, damn.
Really?
Yeah. So, but he's a young grandpa. Yeah.
Yeah, great. Still, he's grandpa.
Yeah.
Do you have a top five of your experiences that you've had in film?
Well, yeah, I think the experience sort of goes with the role, right? I mean, kind of when the role's really good, the experience mm-hmm. is a little bit better.
Generally speaking.
But the
environments can be not so hot.
Well, that's true, too. I mean, environments can be not so great. And I've done some leads in some movies that shall go unnamed by me. But obviously, the body double was a great experience with Brian, and it was a great experience for me. And, you know, we're talking about improv and things like that. Anything I wanted to add in the thing, he was
down for.
He was down for. Yeah. So it was really cool. And then also in the acting class scene in that, he duplicated that push-in shot that he did in Scarface, that sort of floating in. On me shot.
Right.
It's almost identical length of time. It's really kind of weird. But at any rate, Payback, I think, was a great experience and a great part. And just had a lot of fun shooting it. And, you know, shooting in Chicago with Indian Summer, you know, it was
not so bad.
Great time to be there, you know.
Right.
As opposed to those times of Chicago in February.
Exactly.
You know, but I've done other things. But those two are great, you know. One that I had a great experience that in the movie is like, it was called Fair Game. But its original title was Mamba. It was a snake picture. But it was... I got to go to Rome for 2 months. I had to shoot at Cinecittà, the great studio.
Nothing wrong with that. Yeah.
Wow.
With this amazing bunch of people. Dante Spinotti shot it. Melina Caninaro was costumes. Fernando Scarfiotti was the set. And the director was just, he had been a producer of sort of their early work, so they all came to do this favor for him.
Right.
So the movie looked gorgeous. The script was always a problem, but but it was a great time.
A great time in Rome.
Right? So you have those kind of experiences too, but the actual working experience, that was the most fun was Slither with James Gunn. Mm-hmm. And it was Nathan Fillion and Elizabeth Banks and Michael Rooker, and we all just laughed all the time.
Yeah.
Just what could be, you know, what could we think of that was going to be more outrageously funny? And, you know, the script was already hilarious. That was just a lot of fun. And we all remained, you know, pretty close, which doesn't happen often.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. That's fortunate. Does Grandpa show up in the remaining Guardians? Has Grandpa...
I just don't know.
Have you made it through?
I just don't know.
Have you not died?
Not dead yet.
You're not dead yet. That's saying a lot.
Do you have a preference for film or television or theater? You'd rather work on one of the three?
No, I'm pretty even-handed about there.
Work is work?
Work is work, yeah. Yeah.
You've done a lot of TV. You were on Scandal for 23 episodes.
I was, yeah.
How was that experience?
That was a beautiful experience. You know, I probably should have added it to the list there because that was a great company. And Shonda was a great boss to work for. Everybody was... it's funny in this sort of time when, you know, we're not sure what kind of malevolent force might have taken over Twitter, but but Shonda and the cast of that show really sort of, maybe not the first, but first sort of big one that I was aware of using it to promote and connect with fans and connect with the audience. Mm-hmm. And they really sort of, help push the success of that show with it. And so that was kind of an interesting thing. So they'd have a screening, a pre-screening, so you could see the thing.
Yeah.
And then you could tweet live.
Oh, wow.
Right, when it came on live. So so sometimes they were like parties that they had. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, was very curmudgeonly about Twitter. I didn't join until sort of the last few episodes. But because of all that sort of camaraderie that we had at those sort of like parties, those get-togethers, the cast was very, very close and wonderful. You know, led by Carrie, of course, who is just
the greatest.
Yeah. She's just the best.
Oh, yeah. Cool. We try to have a community here, right, guys?
Yeah.
Yeah,
we spend a lot of time on Twitter here.
That's true.
It makes a big difference. So.
Yeah,
well, it does. Yeah, it does. And it's fun. I hope.
In fact, we're going to have a fan question segment soon, where all of our questions are coming off of the internet. So,
Can you talk about Hit and Run a little bit?
How
the experience was?
Yeah, it was for Netflix, shot in New York for 4 months, and then the rest of it was to shoot in Israel for 2 more months. And so we were one of the victims of the pandemic in that way. We had 10 episodes that we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the New York section. I went to Israel once, came back. Then Lisa and I went to Israel, and we finished my shooting. Got back here on 1st of March, mm-hmm. and Israel closed down like mm-hmm. 8 days later.
Yeah.
The 9th, yeah.
And so then we didn't finish filming for another 16 months.
Wow.
We
shut down that long.
Wow.
Because Israel was tighter clamped than even the U.S. at that point in time. And you couldn't get the Americans in to work on it that had to work on it, and it was that kind of situation. So, you know, momentum kind of suffered a little bit from that. But the end result is great. And the end result is one episode shorter. It's 9 episodes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's Mike Barker directing. And it stars Lior Raz, who people out there might know from Fauda, which is also on Netflix. Mm-hmm. He's a wonderful Israeli actor, star at this point. And it's sort of a show of international intrigue, you know, Mossad, CIA,
mm-hmm.
US, you know, spies, all that kind of stuff, you know, and it's a wonderful show. It just has a great look. It has this great sort of throwback look to the 70s that they did. So it has that kind of saturated dark look to it, it got wonderful reviews, top 10, 3 weeks in a row on Netflix.
Oh, wow.
And then the 4th week, we were canceled. So that's what it was.
Oh, heavens.
Oh, Netflix. Oh, my God.
But it all makes sense.
The upside, the upside of that is it's still there. That's a good thing about Netflix. You just go put hit and run, and it's a great show.
Cool.
So,
you got the notification of being canceled after episode 4, but it went 9 or only went
after 4 weeks of being in the top 10 on Netflix. Oh, gotcha. You know how they do top 10,
right.
It stayed there after we were canceled too for a while. But at any rate, it's just sort of like you're up, you're down, you know, that sort of thing.
Speaking of the pandemic, were you productive during our time locked in?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I wrote a bunch of songs and recorded them, and some of them are being released on an album called Pretty Crime that'll be out in a couple of weeks wherever you stream your music. But in terms of my music, we should tell people that I go under my full name, which is Greg Lee Henry. So sometimes if you look for Greg Henry, it doesn't show up. But
okay.
Greg Lee Henry is the where all my music is. So I did that, and I wrote a couple plays, and they're being guided. So that's kind of what I did, you know, because what else do you do?
What else do you do?
Some people did absolutely nothing.
I was waiting for.
I wore my pajamas.
Watched a lot of Netflix.
I wore my pajamas and did that too. You know,
you wrote and wore your pajamas.
Yeah. Has anybody else found out that they're a little binge burned?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
I was so deeply into it. We were like, yeah, we're going through it at night. Yeah, right. We're going to do it tomorrow.
Yeah. Stay up till 4 in the morning.
We watched 9 hours of television just now.
Yeah. And now I'm like, it's a good show. Okay, good. Yeah. I'll watch one. And, you know.
Do you mind if we play some of your music, having mentioned it?
Sure, I'd love it. Okay. I'd love it. Yeah, absolutely.
Chris has it.
It's You the One. This is a re-recording of a song that I wrote a while ago. The others, you know, there's two others that are re-recordings, and all the others are brand new. But this was, it's called You the One, and I originally wrote this and performed this on a show called The Riches, which some people might remember, which was on FX.
I liked that show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great show.
And I performed it at Hugh Panetta's wedding. That was the character I played. But I just loved that song, and I thought I'd give it another sort of little bit more up-tempo version. So this is what I did.
Don't want to get up, don't know about you. Let's just stay here and do what we do. You the one, baby. You the one. You're the one I love. You're too, too fine. All time, you the one.
Oh, that's fun.
That's great. Yeah. What are your musical influences? I was saying earlier that, you know, when you were playing downstairs, that I hear some Leon Russell, some maybe some Dr. John.
Both of those. You you got good ears. Dr. John certainly. Songwriting wise, it's Randy Newman is like, you know, my God.
Yeah.
And but piano wise, it really was those guys. It was sort of Leon Russell, Dr. John, Ray Charles, people that are, you know, and Jerry Lee and Little Richard, other sort of people that are more sort of basic rock and roll.
Right.
Yeah.
I really wish that there would be a renaissance or a resurgence of Randy Newman's earlier stuff. You know, most people know him as, you know, the Disney song guy.
The guy who did Toy Story.
My God, he has the 70s and the 80s. Some albums are just extraordinary. I mean, I remember not knowing really who he was except for Short People.
Yeah.
That song when I was a kid. Rolling Stone had done the best 100 albums of all time. And he's got like 4 in the top 20. And I was like, really?
Oh, really?
But I mean, and then I went and listened to him, and he's
Oh, he's just
about as good as they get.
Yeah, he's top of the heap in my opinion. And I was lucky enough to work with him and meet him.
Oh, wow.
We did I did a show called The Education of Randy Newman down at South Coast Rep.
Mm.
And we workshopped it for a full year before we did it. So that meant that there were three other times before we went into production that, you know, Randy would come down and we'd get to have lunch with him and, okay, you know, and work on the songs and sort of get the feel of what he wanted and what he was like as a composer. And he was, just phenomenal ear, you know. He's, yeah. No, that's a B, not a B flat, you know. And but funny as hell, and his sort of understanding and appreciation of all American music and sort of film scores that he's done and all of that, and coming up in the era of sort of rock and roll, he just has this sort of comprehensive musical look of American music. And I think lyrically, he's just so funny and so smart and so quick. And so.
How about we do some fan questions?
Okay, let's do that. Okay.
Let's do it. Jan Eric Hearn from Patreon asks, was there a big difference in the production values, filming, etc. when you compare Enterprise versus Firefly?
Oh, Enterprise versus Firefly. That's
we're going to have a couple of those.
Came in from left field a little bit there. Well, what I recall of Firefly, you know, we had a lot that was sort of outside. I mean, there was the train set, but we had things that were outside the train, this kind of dusty outside thing. And the outside that we had was a different planet, and it was dusty, but it was on a stage.
Yeah.
So, the production value in that way was a bit different. And Firefly was a new show. Mm-hmm. By the time I did Star Trek, it's like it's an American institution. So all the just sort of the working procedure that you sort of feel and sense and actually, you know, deal with as you come on to something, you know, Star Trek was a well-oiled machine,
right?
Mm-hmm. You know, and Firefly, there were no glitches or problems. We didn't go over or anything, but it was. There was just a sort of a rookie feel about it. There was just a new feel about it, but it was great to do. And Nathan, that's where I first worked with Nathan Fillion, and who is just a wonderful guy and funny as he can be. I mean, he'll crack you up. And he just made it a great experience. He was very welcoming to the set, and we had a great time. You know. On Star Trek, we worked pretty hard at that makeup, and then we worked really hard at that fight. And, and that's kind of where it was a demarcation point in my career, that fight, you know, because, stunt choreographer was putting me through the paces and I had to do this leg whip and I could do it. And I did it. And then they said, come look at it. And I looked out on videotape. And I was like, you know, that guy in the lizard makeup looks exactly like me. Let's get him in
Let's
there.
Get his leg whip.
So, so that was kind of it's one of those markers in your career.
Awesome.
Were you surprised that Firefly got canceled so soon?
I was, because I thought it was a really good show. I mean, I really liked it. And then, of course, you find out how the fans feel about it.
Oh, they're nuts.
Yeah. Oh, the brown nuts. Shirts. Yeah.
If they were able to engage.
Wash.
Earlier.
Yeah. Oh, they were like 2 years
it probably
before the internet. Yeah.
It probably would have gone on, you know? Yeah.
I mean, it's extraordinary. They did, 9 episodes, and a show that did 9 episodes and got canceled got a movie
out
of it.
Yeah. And like the original series, Star Trek, the original series, it's one of those shows that shot a pilot. The network didn't understand it, had them reshoot another pilot, and then played the episodes out of order, just like the original series of Star Trek. And then it got canceled early. Like, I mean, it had a lot of the same markers that Star Trek had.
I didn't know that history. That's interesting.
Yeah. It was.
They've got board games. They have.
Yeah.
Movies, board games.
They still have a huge fan base, right?
Fan fiction of it home movies and there's probably Firefly in the dark webs of porn.
I'm surprised they haven't brought it back at all.
They made a movie, Serenity.
Yeah, sure.
Our beloved avocado tree over here is named Wash.
Yeah.
After Firefly. A lot of our fans are also Firefly fans.
Silent partner back there.
Hi, Wash.
Yeah, it wasn't my idea. All right, what else you got?
We're cutting the part where the avocado tree interviews me.
That's the best part of the show.
It's our version of Between Two Ferns.
Oh, that's funny. I love
that. Oh, my God.
That show is so funny.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Rachel from Patreon asks us, having been on Enterprise and Firefly, if you could appear on any other sci-fi show, past or present, which would it be and why?
Really good question. I really sort of like, it's not really science fiction though. Well, it kind of is. I really like Stranger Things. I like that show.
Mm-hmm.
In what way is that not sci-fi?
I think that counts.
Well, I'm not a real aficionado, so I'm not, but I love that show Station 11. That I thought was kind of cool. But I don't have any at my fingertips. Mm. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Next question. Fran Castile from Patreon asks, what was it like working with Nathan Fillion?
Well, I might have already said a little bit of that.
Yeah.
No, he's just... he's... He has this this quality that is often sort of talked about leading men or leading women that is there's a kind of a magnetism, and there's also sort of a leadership quality and he does his through just being a wonderful human being to other people, kind to all, and being hilarious. I mean, he is a very funny guy, and I like him tremendously. I consider him a friend. I don't know if any of you saw the Much Ado About Nothing that he did, where he was Dogberry, where he played Dogberry.
I didn't see.
Yeah, they filmed it at what's his face's house, right?
Yeah, Josh. Josh
Whedon's house.
Josh Whedon's house. They filmed it there. But it's the best Dogberry I've ever seen. Really? got these jokes that are 600 years old and got them to be just so funny.
No easy task.
No. You've been there.
Oh, yeah. I've been in Much Ado a few times. Dogberry comes out with the crew and you're like, oh, Jesus. Nobody's going to get this.
Yeah. It's like, who is going to get this joke? Yeah.
How many times have you worked with him then?
Firefly, Slither,
Castle.
He was in Guardians, but we didn't work together. And that's it, I think. Mm-hmm. No, and did he float through Super? He floated through that, but we didn't do anything together either. But I think he was in it.
Who was he in Guardians?
He was a large science fiction type character.
Thanks
for clarifying.
I'm dying here.
Next question.
Sorry, that's what IMDb is.
Bill Erickson from Patreon asks, Connor Trinneer, Nathan Fillion, or Brian De Palma, who is the most fun to work with?
Well, it's Connor Trinneer.
That's a very good answer.
Sweet.
We've said a lot without actually saying anything.
We spent the whole day thumping each other, still friends.
See?
Fazia Rizvi, one of our dear Patreon members, asks us, or she has a
some comments and questions. Wow, he's had a long career and in a zillion of the shows. I remember the names of Love Boat, Moonlighting, Murder, She Wrote, Matlock, Designing Woman, In the Heat of the Night, on and on. I'd love to hear about his career in the 80s and guest starring on these string of hit shows. What was his most memorable set experience, favorite role, or literally anything about working with Angela Lansbury? I also see an uncredited role on the movie Scarface,
which we talked about
Scarface. Whoa. Any memories to share about that one?
Which we did.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Angela Lansbury?
I'd love to talk about Angela because she's just, she was just the best. There was a thing in the 80s that happened, and you're just a young pup, so I don't think you were started yet, but there was like, there used to be a time when you did television and you were an actor, you negotiated your deal, and then you got your next show, and you say, well, I got this on my last show, so...
My rate is.
So could you give me a little bump? And that was kind of traditionally how it worked, and that's how you built your sort of career and your salary over time. But came the 80s, and somebody came up with a phrase called top of the show. And across the board, people were like, you know, oh no, that's all we're paying.
Top of show.
That's it. Not Murder, She Wrote, because of Angela Lansbury. Angela Lansbury thought actors should be paid and thought they should be paid well and that they should be able to have an increase in their salary. So that was the philosophy on that show. So for that reason, that's one reason. But the other reason is she was always so kind and warm to me. And really, I don't know how many I did. Five or six of them over the years. And she was the funniest thing was she was sort of joking on herself because of the first year that we did it. I think it was called Broadway Malady, and it had all these great Broadway stars in it. And that's what
the show was called.
The title of the Murder, She Wrote episode. It was called Broadway Malady, I think. Who was it? Vivian Blaine and just like great old Broadway stars in it. And Angela, of course, had her summation. You know, at the end, as you left, the butler saw your eye and left it, you know, whatever that sort of summation is. But it's always long, you know. And the first season, she was just like, she clipped that thing off. By the time it came around to the last one, she joked about it. She says, yes, now I have it written right there. You see there? And so there was a big card. And she would do her summation that way. Yeah. But she was brilliant. She was a genius actor and a lovely, lovely woman.
Awesome.
That's what's with you.
Great. Well, that wraps up our fan questions for today, unless anyone...
I was wondering about the episode, how you knew what the meaning of what you were saying was and wasn't actually that.
Well, I really do think, Chris, that they sort of like parenthetically sort of said what, you know, baracha, or whatever that meant, right. You know, or zaka. And later we sort of, as we learn each other's language, so that sort of like was obviously written out in parentheses. There's one little, those first sort of couple of sentences I have in it. I just did it phonetically. There must have been intent there because otherwise how would I know what I was doing?
Yeah. So,
you know, it's funny. I was really excited to meet you as you, and I don't believe I ever got to.
I don't think so. No, because, I'd show up. I'd look like,
yeah. And then at the very end, I think we were in sick bay and just had a brief, like, it was really great working with you and all that. And, then you had to go spend another, you know, hour taking your makeup off and you were so tired. I mean, that was a run for you that, you know, one being in that, the contact lens thing is extraordinary. in terms of how tired it makes you.
Mm. It wears you out. Yeah.
Yeah. Just the eyes alone. And then obviously I'm sure you had to like drain the suit from the sweat that happens when you got that headpiece on. It's just miserable. No, it's awful.
You always got to bring up the you know, like the makeup suit.
Truly, like, you know, the Ferengis on Deep Space Nine, they would always be like, you know, by the end of the day, they'd hear the sloshing.
Oh God!
In the headpiece. No, it's a real thing. It's got nowhere to go.
Yeah, that's what would happen. When I did Body Double, I played the Indian in Body Double. It was like even kind of more extensive. It was like 4.5 hour makeup, but it was like full with neck piece and chest piece. You know, fucking long. I said fucking sorry. long. It's okay. This long, you know, wig and these teeth and everything, and because of the neck piece and chest piece in that one, nowhere to go.
Yeah.
So the end of the day would be like very tired.
Did you have in the Enterprise episode, did you also have a mouth?
Like
a weird teeth thing or something?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Uppers and lowers. Yeah. And then the contacts as well, which were quite eerie.
So you did this episode of Enterprise after you did Star Trek Insurrection.
After Insurrection, yeah.
And Insurrection, you also had pretty intense makeup.
It was, but kind of child's play. No, it was the stretchy face sort of thing. And in the first sort of, in terms of time that you had to put in, it was a little bit longer because they were trying to get so many people had to have this look. And so mm-hmm. they kept mm-hmm. adapting it and adjusting it and everything. But then once it was set, it went pretty quickly. But that too had like the headpiece attached to the appliance here. So it's like, it was warm. But,
yeah. How'd you like working with Frakes? I think he's just one of the greatest guys.
Oh, I love him. I love him. I consider him a friend. I've worked with him a couple times since then. He's had me come do some stuff for him, and he's great. You know, knows what he's doing, knows when to keep it, you know, light and yet good.
Exactly.
You should tell him you had a good time on our show and see if he'll come and do our show.
All right, I will.
Give us a recommendation.
Okay.
Hey, Frakes, if you're not busy.
Frakes, two thumbs up.
Up in the attic at the Matrix. They're doing a thing.
Well, so like Insurrection was your first job on Star Trek, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things that we've found very enjoyable here is talking about how you got your role. How did you get the audition? What was the process like?
You know, meeting from the agent, you know, go up and read. Went up and read, sat in those narrow hallways in Paramount, you know. They got like 12 chairs lined up, you're all sitting there. And was extensive. I went in the first time, you know, Frakes was there. I don't know that Berman was there the first one.
Probably not.
I don't think so. But then it was like, you know, I was back. I think at least three times, maybe four times, auditioning for that. And Berman was there certainly the last two times. Mm-hmm. So I had to work for it.
Did you just shoot that episode for one day?
No, good God.
I didn't think so. Many days was it about?
Typically, what they try to do is make our show was a 7-day shoot.
Oh,
it never did that. We always went over. You always go over.
Yeah.
Though I would say we might have been able to because it was just you and I, really.
It was kind of the bottle show. Yeah, it was kind of, you know, but we hit it for 5 days easy.
Oh, yeah.
At least one working week, you know.
Right.
I think more.
But generally it would be, you know, on any show you get near the end of the season and you're shooting the show that you're meant to be shooting. And then second unit is taking pieces of two episodes ago or the previous episode. And they're just trying to bang out those scenes that they have to get done that they weren't able to during the time that they were on schedule.
Right.
So they got the other team doing 6 or 8 things. And by the end of our seasons, they'd have to tell us what episode we were shooting, maybe go change your clothes, whatever. And then they kind of have to tell you what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, you're like,
yeah, exactly.
What's happening here? And you know, you just sort of piecemeal it together by the end of the year.
Do I have the limp yet or not?
Exactly. Yeah.
This week for Star Trek trivia, Connor and Greg are playing for Eve England, our Patreon member. Thank you, Eve, so much for your support.
If we win, you get a brand new car.
Not yet. Maybe soon.
I don't think you're going to win. Anyway, we're going to try though.
I'm going to give it my all.
That's right.
Yes. Five questions, all multiple choice. We'll do it buzzer style. You guys ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Say your name for a buzzer.
Question number one. What is the name of Will Riker's twin? A, Billy. B, Anthony. C, Thomas. Or D, Ed?
Connor.
Ooh.
Wow.
See? What do you think? Billy, Ted, Bob,
Mark.
Ooh. No, I didn't say anything yet.
Yeah.
C. Let's go with C.
Okay.
You're right. It's C. Thomas.
You guessed. You
love I think he's going to get a new car.
Yeah, baby. I'd start looking through the new automobiles. Yeah, that's right.
Question number two. Who does Captain Kirk marry in The Paradise Syndrome? Season 3, Episode 3. A, Miramani. B, Shauna. C, Nairobi. D, Dila.
Mark. Miramani.
Yes, the answer is A, Miramani.
That seems kind of shady.
I mean, I know the answer. She's the Native American...
Could have been a tell.
I think so.
She's the Native American girl who's been promised to the medicine man of their tribe on this planet that's exactly like Earth, which is like a common theme in the original Star Trek. And I think she gets stoned to death at the end because... I don't remember why, but she ends up marrying Kirk and it really upsets the guy who's supposed to be the medicine man on the planet. Also the fact that you corrected the pronunciation.
I know. But there's also no way you know that. So there's no way Mark didn't know that.
Yeah.
So she marries him and then she gets stoned to death?
Yeah, Kirk gets, they think he's a god because he came down from the Enterprise and he becomes the medicine man and the pillar they worship or whatever is actually a computer that's taking care of them, which is another very popular Star Trek theme. And they stone her.
It's like the man who would be king.
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
Sean Connery.
Oh, Sean Connery. There we go.
Michael Caine.
So,
okay, all right.
All right.
One to one.
Well, you guessed.
One to one.
The first one. You got lucky.
That's true.
Question number three. Where was Voyager Chief Engineer B'Elanna Torres born? A, New Gaul. B, Kronos. C, Earth. Or D, Kessick?
Connor? B.
Damn it. Nope.
What was the last one?
Chicago.
D, Kessick 4.
Mark? Kessick 4?
Correct. The answer is Kessick 4, D. Oh my god!
I told you.
There's like these little tells.
I know. Exactly.
I did not have anything to do with these questions.
A tell like this.
All right. So.
All right. Question number four: which Star Trek character was part of the interspecies medical exchange? A. Dr. Pulaski. B. Dr. McCoy. C. Dr. Bashir. Or D. Dr. Phlox.
Mark. Dr. Phlox.
Yes, the answer is D, Dr. Phlox.
Only one of those people was a different...
This is fun, isn't it? I know he is. Yeah, he did.
Well,
write
Connor should have known because he was in that show.
I do know who Dr. Phlox is, but other than that,
interspecies,
I have no
medical
help.
Exchange.
Yeah, I didn't know that there was a...
Interplanetary or interspecies? It doesn't matter.
There were 99 of them.
Look, I know who he is.
Interspecies.
Right? That's good enough.
Yeah, he was our first guest. Okay. Question number five. In The Trouble with Tribbles, which crew member brought a tribble on board? A, Uhura. B, McCoy. C, Sulu. Or D, Scotty?
Mark.
Connor. Nuts.
Uhura.
Yes, it was Lieutenant Uhura.
I was nervous for a second.
With a pause.
I was like, oh shit, was it Chekhov?
I love how passionate you are about winning.
Out of curiosity, did you know it, Connor?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. You did.
Sulu. Right?
I'm kidding.
That was good.
Yeah. All right. Would you like to hear the results?
No. I think it was 4-1.
The results. Connor and Greg won. Mark 4.
Well, Eve, I'm sorry.
So if we can just edit the last half of that sentence.
Yeah.
Eve England, you're still a great patron.
Eve, I'm sorry we couldn't get you that 1983 Sentra, but we tried.
Did our very best.
Yeah. Eve, Connor and Greg lost that Star Trek trivia just for you.
Yep.
Well, thank you guys for being a good support.
Well, we didn't have a
choice. Eve.
Yeah.
Thank you, Eve. All right. Moving on, you guys.
Are you reading a book right now? Are you watching any TV right now that you're
I am reading City of Fire by Don Winslow right now. I'm a big Don Winslow fan. I've read all the three books of the Border Trilogy, The Cartel, Dogs of War, and The Border. And this is the first of his new trilogy, which is all about the Irish and the Italian mobs in Rhode Island.
Oh.
Yeah.
Fun.
I don't know his books.
So that, and I just finished the Stephen King fairy tale, which is... I loved. It was great fun.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Have you always been a big reader?
I don't know. I like to read. I usually have a book that I'm reading. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Awesome. Connor, anything new?
Reading? God, yes. I just picked up a book. It's riveting because I can't remember what it's called. It is a historical fiction. I'm 10 pages in, so I don't quite know exactly what it's about yet. But yeah. I keep saying this. Have you ever taken The New Yorker as a magazine?
Oh, like a subscription?
Yeah.
No, I think I always get other people's copies.
It's an impossible task to keep up.
Yeah.
Comes out every week. And to get through an issue, I've never met anyone. Well, John Billingsley, that's not true.
He said John goes, cuts the list out and goes through every one of them.
Right. I've kept up as best I can on my New Yorkers. Will say this.
That's a lot of reading.
Yeah. The pandemic actually sort of murdered reading for me. I don't know why. You'd think I would have read the whole time, but I binged watched stuff and
there's no vaccine for that.
There is no vaccine for that. And I lost my mojo on, cause I was a daily reader and now I'm trying to get that back.
That's funny.
Yeah. TV. Anything in, on the screen you're watching?
Well, we loved Bad Sisters. We watched that recently. The Watcher, we liked that a lot. That was fun. We watched that recently. What other sort of series do we watch?
Do you have like a favorite series? Like of all time, if you had only had one more series you could ever rewatch? Right?
Huh. Oh, God, that's a lot of volume there, you know? Come up with one.
I think I'd have to say Cheers. I've seen all the Star Trek 60 times. I'll watch Cheers again.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to bow out of that.
You're allowed to bow out.
You're
going to
keep that to yourself.
Yeah. Find that some things are just too personal.
Yeah, I think that's true. No,
it's my TV time, and I'm going to take it.
That's
just
true.
Close the door.
Did you happen to see The Offer?
I love The Offer. Yeah, we loved watching that.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that was great fun.
Yeah, they're now.
We're still on Paramount that way. We're giving the Paramount Plus thing.
So, loved Paramount.
They're doing this similar treatment to Chinatown.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah,
that'll be cool.
Yeah.
No, it was particularly fun because you know, you sort of know all the characters involved, you know, and to see it from a different perspective, it was great. It was a lot of fun.
It was well done.
Yeah.
Okay, we're gonna resurrect something I did early on in season one, and that is Stuck on a Deserted Island
with Connor Trinneer.
Not actually. With me, but I'm hosting it. So, Greg,
this is he's hosting favorite. It remotely.
Yeah, exactly. To you, so you're stuck on a deserted island. You obviously, you don't have to worry about your protein. There are three things that you can have. And this is the rest of your life.
The rest of my life.
The rest of your life.
Okay.
A musician, artist, whatever, composer. Their complete work.
Ooh.
A dessert. So if you pick ice cream, you get all the ice cream. If you pick cupcakes, you get all the cupcakes. and then an author. Their complete works.
Wow.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So it's for the rest of my life.
Yeah. And you're alone.
Well, let's get one thing out of the way. It's ice cream.
There you go.
I saw the look in your eyes when he mentioned ice cream.
Uh-huh. That one's pretty simple. Musician is
can be a band as well. Obviously.
Is a little musician because there's so many that are so great, and that I could listen to all the time.
I'd go with myself.
Randy's up there. Dr. John is up there. Both of those two are, you know. But it's funny. I listen to, I love the B.B. King Blues Station on Sirius XM. And, anytime B.B. comes on, I turn it up.
You feel better.
And I feel better. Yeah. So, anyway, those would be some of them that are in contention.
You have to pick one. It can change the next time.
Couldn't it be like an archipelago, and I could be like one island over and work my way?
This is my B.B. King Island.
Okay, I would say I'm going to go with Dr. John.
Okay,
there it is.
Yeah. And now your author.
Tricky, for my enrichment, I should probably pick Shakespeare, but I don't know if I'd have that much fun. Really. I mean, some fun. I do this kind of thing. Sometimes I get authors and I just go like, okay, and I'm reading them, and I go through books and I've kind of done that with Don Winslow now. So this guy that I'm reading right now. And I like that kind of form, and I sort of got to like that form originally, because of Elmore Leonard's books. And so, if I got them all, I probably take Elmore Leonard cause he makes me laugh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. What a good answer.
Yeah. Good choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a good reason.
I only say Shakespeare because I could turn the rocks into characters and I'd now have friends to talk to. From I'd do all the plays, but I'd actually act them out, and I've got a long time to stay there.
You've thought about this.
Well, I've done this a lot. And in fact, I've changed my answers over time.
Yeah, I think you should be able to give a different answer every week.
Exactly.
Yeah. I like the idea of doing if you're stuck on an island with Connor Trinneer.
Yeah. One of you's not getting off of the island.
What would you read with Connor?
Right.
What would Connor read to you?
What would Connor read to you?
Over left-hand soup.
What would Connor make for dinner?
Yeah, exactly.
Nothing good.
Cupcakes.
Depends on the island.
That's right.
Well, that's fun. Thank you for playing.
Thank you for playing.
What do I win?
Deserted island.
What do I win?
An 83
all
century.
The ice cream in
all the ice cream.
All the ice
cream. Nice.
How well do we know our guest is the next segment. All right. Question number one.
Mm-hmm.
Where did Greg go to university?
Well, the one that he mentioned was the University of Washington.
Correct.
Go Huskers.
Killing it. How much was Greg making a week at the Old Globe in San Diego?
As an intern, I believe he said $60.
Yep.
Wow.
Question number three. What was Greg's first movie with De Palma?
Crap.
You know it.
Scarface.
Yep.
Yeah.
Correct. What was Greg's first movie with James Gunn?
Was it Slither?
Yes.
He was paying attention the whole time.
Question number five, last question. Greg's song, You the One, was originally performed on which show?
That was performed on, wasn't it Cagney and Lacey?
Don't do it.
I don't do it. I don't remember.
Nuts.
The Riches. But you got 4 out of 5, Connor.
Right. That's pretty damn good.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
You get the plant.
You get the plant. Well done, Connor.
Good Thanks. Job, Connor. You're Thank a great
you.
Listener.
Thank you. Well, listen, it's been a fantastic afternoon with you. Thank you so much for coming on our show.
You bet. Yeah. It's been fun.
Yeah, it's good it's to see fun. It's good to see you again in the flesh.
This is what I look like. I looked much better back then.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you. This has been a blast. Appreciate it.
Great, thanks, man.
Yeah.
Like, subscribe, and join us on Patreon.